Today's News Talk Radio, TNT, with Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast.
I don't know where to start with my next guest. He's a lord, for one. I've never talked to a lord. I don't even really know what a lord is or how you become a lord. I know the Lord. I love the Lord. I pray to the Lord. He's not that, but he is Lord Conrad Black. He also came from extravagant means. I mean, in this day and age, it's the haves and have-nots. It seems like we're being decimated by the so-called elites. He seems to be qualified as one of those, and yet he's a rebel. He's been to prison. I mean, he's done time. You know that weird bourbon ad about the most interesting man in the world? I think this guy qualifies as the most interesting man in the world. Let's find out. Also, he's also a writer of many, many, many books. So that means he spent a lot of time hanging out writing. That's what that means. He is a longtime columnist, author, including having written a column for the National Post since he founded it in 1998. He has written 11 books, mostly in the fields of Canadian and American history, including biographies of U.S. presidents Franklin D. Roosevelt, Richard Nixon, and Donald Trump. Nixon, he's a misunderstood guy, isn't he? As well as two memoirs, and his latest is The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. He's here with us now. Lord Conrad Black, welcome to the show. I am intimidated to talk to you, sir. Maybe it's because you have Lord in your name. How do you become a Lord? Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Joseph. Look, I'm just a member of the masses, like your viewers. You become a lord by supposedly meritocratic activity in Great Britain and on behalf of Great Britain. And in my case, I followed in the tradition by which the owners of the large national newspapers, you know, the whole country is compacted into one time zone. So the morning papers in Britain circulate throughout the country. And I was the owner of one. So I was like Lord Beaverbrook or Lord Thompson or Lord Rothermere, I became a lord. But that and the correct fare will get me on the public transit system anywhere in the world. So
It sounds cool, though.
I know it's good for making dinner reservations in England, and it's good. I have to say, I get to sit in the upper house of their parliament, the House of Lords, and there is this theory that it's all inherited pompous British idiots who spend all their time fox hunting or something. It's not the case. The hereditaries are down to a small number. And when you have a debate on a serious subject, I remember when I spoke in the debate on the Second Iraq War, I spoke right after Margaret Thatcher, the former Secretary General of NATO, the Chief of the Defense Staff, the Chancellor of Oxford University, the writer P.D. James, the impresario Andrew Lloyd Webber. I mean, it's a very serious house, and it's a very good esprit in that house. And in the debates, you know, there's no shouting at each other. Everything's polite, but the quality of debate is high. And at the end of it, you go to the peers bar and continue it. And as long as a member of their lordship house wants a drink, the bar is open.
And so you have some Guinness, some pints, right?
I can't bear warm stout, but I have some wine or occasionally a little whiskey. Good Scottish whiskey.
Nice. I'm Scott. Well, I come from Scottish descent, so I can relate. Arthur.
You're a long way from a Scottish accent, but that doesn't matter. You know,
I'm from Ohio.
Well, there you go.
Let me ask you this. So we were just talking. Also, though, the Lord thing, I saw some criticism, like you renounced your Canadianness or something.
Yeah, that was complete lordship. Nonsense.
Is that nonsense? Okay.
No, never mind. I am back as a Canadian, a dual citizen, as I said I would. What happened in one sense is the then Prime Minister of this country, Canada, Chrétien, who I'd been friendly with for decades, thought that we'd written some things about him which were ultimately completely upheld by a royal commission, I may say. So he intervened and told the late Queen that Canadian law required him to oppose my appointment to the House of Lords, which it didn't. He was not telling her the truth, and she knew it. But I said, look, the Queen mustn't be embarrassed with nonsense like this. I'll renounce my Canadian citizenship, accept the lordship, and then I'll reapply. And that's what's happened, and I'm back. It was all nonsense.
All right, whatever. That's just some internet criticism. There's tons of that about on all of us that haven't done anything or said anything.
But I want to defend myself against the charge of chucking in my birthright for an easily caricatured honor in another country. But I did not. And I'm here. I am in Canada, and I'm part of the landscape here and in England. Both. I'm proud. They're both great countries. I'm proud to be a citizen of both.
Okay, and now Canada, though, just so right before we came on, I was asking about what Bill Maher's latest takedown. I just saw a little clip of it about Canada and how woke and extreme it's gotten. I mean, I don't know if you saw it or not. I couldn't hear your response.
I can't bear Bill Maher. He's a greaser, although I admit he has his moments. He's he's getting more sensible now.
Slightly.
Okay, well, I think I can imagine the things he said, and he's right, except that these are... these are asinine things that the present government is doing. They're all subject to review by the courts, and for the most part, ludicrously woke things that they do that could potentially compromise people's rights of free speech and so on are corrected by the courts. But I have to say, I speak as someone who, despite the horrible injustices I suffered in your country, is pro-American. And I've written a history of the United States that would demonstrate that. Despite that, I have to tell you, we don't indict the leader of the opposition. We don't throw a bunch of spurious prosecutions at opposition figures coming up to an election. And the media in Canada is, in my opinion, quite poor, but it isn't so monochromatically partisan as your national political media are. So,
fired.
Glass house, you know, and we have low crime rates. We don't have anyone trying to defund the police. We don't have the police improperly trained and shooting innocent people very often. So, you tell Bill Maher that he can wash his hair, change his haircut, and look in the national mirror. But yes, he's right. Canada's done some stupid things, and most Canadians know it, and we're going to change the government.
Now, I'm sure, whatever to Bill Maher, but I'm sure the hair is some pomade. Come on. It's not really grease from not washing it. Come on, Lord Conrad Black. You know it. You brought up.
It matters of the hair salon. Fortunately, I have enough hair to go for my age, and I don't do anything except brush it. Wash it.
I wanted to ask you about your dad because he was quite successful, right? And you had mentioned, I think, in an interview, I think he did with Jordan Peterson, where he was like, he retired early and he had lots of money and lots of means, but you said he sort of had an anticlimactic exit from the planet. And that was kind of interesting to me because I the world seems to be subject to elites running amok, right? And this supposed depopulation agenda or whatever the games of control that they're playing. Is there something about having tons of money that just is ultimately dissatisfying, do you think?
Not necessarily at all. In the case of my father, he made a tactical error. He thought, and I think this was a widely held view, in the era of, I'm rather older than you, so say your grandparents, in the 30s, in the Depression and so on, that if you could work until you had enough money to live on for the rest of your life and then just retire and you would sit on a porch in a rocking chair or play golf or whatever you want, that this was like heaven. This is really what life was for. And it really, for most people, it isn't. It wasn't for my father. He's a very intellectual man. And he died of boredom. Now, not right away. He died at the age of 65, which isn't that premature. But I don't think he made the most of the money he'd made. He made it honestly. He made it quickly, but very legitimately, in the great boom after the war. And then he didn't want business disagreements. In the 30s, I think if it hadn't been an economically depressed time, he would have liked to be an academic. Well, he could have become an academic then, but he just basically sat in his house and didn't go out that much, and he had visitors come in, but he just gradually became more and more removed and bored. And then my mother died, and he died not long after. The lesson of that to me is not that you don't change occupations when you're tired of what you're doing, which he was, change occupations, but replace what you're giving up with another activity that engages him. Doesn't matter, you know, as long as it's not sociopathic or illegal, it doesn't matter what it is. You can take up gardening or studying butterflies or whatever you want, but do something and get into it and keep yourself going with it.
How did that not occur for him, though? Because obviously, you know, you're incredibly intelligent. That must have come in part from him. I mean,
he was very intelligent.
I'm sure. So it's like, and you, this would never happen to you. You're a writer, so you could just be writing or whatever. There is
He could have done that too. He was a very stubborn man, and he was convinced that what he was doing was what he wanted to do. And it's very strange. It wasn't. Now, if he could come back now as he was when he died, it was 40 years ago now, but if he could, he would still sit there in his chair and say very eloquently and probably rather humorously that a man can do what he wants and he's king of his castle and so on. And he had quite a little speech that he improvised about what he was doing, because my brother and I, as well as our mother, suggested to him that, you know, he should kind of activate himself a bit. And he would, I'm sure, give us the same refrain. But so it's not for me to judge him. What I did do was judge that wasn't what I wanted to do. So, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to keep going with something or other as long as I can.
Yeah, the root cause of boredom is anger, they say. I wonder if he was angry. I mean, that's interesting.
My brother thought it was the other way around, Joseph. I thought the boredom made him angry. Anger made him a bored person.
Anger's the root cause of all. That's Satan's secret sauce is anger. At every breakdown of humanity, it's nothing to do with Bill Maher. I mean, he's probably angry too, but and I don't know. But so, you know, there's this famous Bob Dylan line. I don't know if you're familiar with Bob Dylan, but he's there's a one
Nobel Prize winner.
I'm helpless as a rich man's child. And my father himself used to always talk about people being victims of trust funds. And so there's this narrative that if you come from means, you're going to essentially be useless or it's going to ruin you. This is opposite of what happened to you. You had means, and yet you're a profound writer, a businessman. I mean, you're making the most of your life, and continue to this day, you're living an opposite reflection of your father. I mean, you're up there beyond.
In some ways, that is true. Yeah, but not. Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize, not out of hostility, just because life is not a life that I wanted, and I personally think, and with the best of goodwill and filial affection, that he made a mistake. And I told him that. And I again, this is a presumptuous thing to say, but I think if he were, if some spirit of him is out there somewhere, I think he would consider that he could have handled it better. But that was his choice to make, and he made it. But that's not what I wanted to do. I admired him in a great many ways, and our relations were excellent, very, very good.
How did you subvert that cliche of being helpless as a rich man's child, as Dylan puts it? How did you escape that?
My father was not the sort of guy that would encourage complacency in his sons, and I was never, and neither was my brother, the sort of person who wanted it ever to be justly said of us that all we did was survive childbirth and had good luck who our parents were. So I always had a motivation to work hard, and I always have worked hard. Whatever I did, I worked hard at.
Right. All right, well, let me take a quick break. We'll be right back with Lord Conrad Black.
By the way, you're right. A lot of scions of the rich, they don't do anything. Or they're thrust into positions they don't want and don't have an aptitude for. It's not all a day at the beach being rich. You know, you got to handle it properly.
that's what I'm trying to get at. Because, you know, if it was a day at the beach, why not just like not try to subjugate and control the rest of humanity? Why not just like, well, I don't know, take up golf?
Like, I'm not trying to subjugate anybody.
Not you, but, you know, Bill Gates, you know, whatever.
Those elite. I don't agree with him politically, but I don't think he's trying to subjugate people.
He's controlling, though. He's wanting to vaccinate everybody. Let me take a quick break. We'll pick it up right after these words on TNT.
TNT's Mark Morano.
Only 54% of the residents of Ethiopia have access to electricity.
Wah, wah, wah.
Ethiopia's leaders are making the country go all electric vehicle when nearly half of the population doesn't have access to electricity. That's commitment. My mind is blown. Do you understand what I'm saying? A country which one of the among the poorest in the world is banning gas-powered cars, EV only, no imports. They're doing their part to fight, quote, planet warming pollution, unquote. And almost half the population doesn't even have access to electricity.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Unbiased information.
Honest and forthright.
News without the misinformation.
It doesn't matter what side you're from. What matters is what you say, the truthfulness behind it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Kneeling neath your ceiling. Yes, I guess I'll be here for a while. I'm trying to read your portrait, but I'm helpless like a rich man's child. How come you sent someone out to have me barred? You know I want your loving, honey. Why are you so hard? Bob Dylan, no one does it better, right? Lord Conrad Black, do you write songs and poetry as well? Or what got you into the written word? And why do you sort of lean mostly on history and biography and such?
No, I wrote a couple of verses for my wife when we were on a cruise in the Greek islands on a yacht that I chartered with some friends, including William Buckley, who was, of course, a very literary person. So I wrote a little poem about her, inspired by the sight of her in a exiguous one-piece bathing suit in one of the Greek islands. And she greeted me as her Lord Byron. And I have not lived down what she considered to be the flattering but ludicrous doggerel that I wrote it ever since. So I've never attempted another poem since then. But I don't think I have an aptitude for that kind of writing. I've always been interested in history, and what happened was I became quite interested in a prominent figure in Quebec when I lived there, and I wrote a biography of him, setting straight the mythology about him, which was that he was a primitive figure who had retarded French Canada. And he wasn't. He was a bit of a political cynic, but he actually modernized French Canada. And then I got this technique of, because I read a lot of history, I developed historical opinions that were sometimes contrary to the conventional wisdom. And in the case of the first American I wrote about was President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt. And I found that the biographies of him were divided between people who sanctified him and canonized him and said that he never did a sneaky thing or devious thing in his life, and those who said he was an absolute washout, virtually a traitor, and that he was swindled by Stalin. And I thought both versions were essentially nonsense. So some of the books were quite well written, such as by my late friend Arthur Schlesinger. But Arthur thought that Roosevelt was a completely forthright person. He wasn't. He was a very devious man. He made you know, it made Machiavelli seem like a Unitarian Sunday school teacher, but almost always in a good cause. So I presented a balance, I felt, and I think the critics have accepted that view of him. You mentioned earlier Mr. Nixon was very misunderstood. There's a picture of me with him at a dinner I had for him here in Toronto behind me. I knew him in his last 5 years, and I agree, he has been terribly misunderstood. He was an outstanding president, one of the best you've had. And even today, 50 years after he resigned, almost, there's not a shred of probative evidence that he committed any crime. Some of his people did,
right,
but he didn't.
Yeah,
and
that's true. And you put a quote, a Milton quote about him, that his soul found peace after all the passions died away, or some such thing like that, right?
Yeah, my soul serene, all passions spent. I thought that was him when I knew him. He said to me that he thought he had on balance, being like yourself, his parents were from Ohio, and you know, his father owned a gas station under which oil was found after he sold it. It was that kind of a family, you know? And he felt that he, I mean, it wasn't like the Rockefellers or Adlai Stevenson or the Kennedys, you know. I mean, nothing wrong with that, but it's a different, you know, different socioeconomic origin. And
It defined him. That he felt like he was sort of always a kind of imposter syndrome, right?
Well, not an imposter. I thought rather doomed to struggle more than was just, but he made a go of it. And he did have a constituency of all those millions of people who worked hard and felt that they were slightly shortchanged and had to work twice as hard for what they mm-hmm. got. And there are an awful lot of people like that, and they feel like that because there's a lot of truth to it. And those people never deserted him. And he managed to develop this non-glamorous, but very respectable and admirable and numerous constituency, and they stuck with him. But he if you look at it, he achieved more in one term, one full term as president, than any other person in one term except Abraham Lincoln, and I think FDR in his first term and his third term. But, I'll recount it, but I'm sure I don't need to for you or your viewers what he achieved. But he doesn't get the credit for it. Now he will. It'll all sort out. Now, he was a somewhat neurotic man, at the time of Watergate. So in a way, his personality played into the tactics of his enemies. But he was a very good president. And
biographies and people's realities, how much do you think we create our own realities?
Do you mean the individuals do, or in the case of public figures, media creates it for them?
No, the us as individuals, how much do you think we create our own realities? I'm thinking of your story, because you know, you write autobiography or biographies of famous characters, they're very interesting people, and you yourself are that. You know, you have a crazy story. I mean, even the stuff, you know, the prison stuff especially, it's like the struggles and the sort of hardships of our life define us in these really interesting ways and intriguing ways that would make for good drama or good movies or good biographies. So I wonder how much you think you've created your own story, including the struggles.
I do believe that the human will does assert itself. It's not all just laid out for us. The day we're born, there isn't some plan that struggles we can't vary from. I think we, of course, a few people are. I mean, in our modern Western societies, relatively few people are born in circumstances where their options are limited. But life is, for the most part, and I guess some people have terrible luck. You know, they come down with awful diseases at early ages, or in car accidents or air crashes or something. I'm not obviously talking about that, but for the most part, we can largely chart our own course, and I've always believed that, and I've always worked to that. You know, I mean, sometimes the circumstances have been extremely adverse, as in the persecution I endured at the hands of your so-called justice system, for which your government has now apologized, by the way. But you have to play the cards you're dealt, and you just do your best job with it. You know,
yeah. So Trump pardoned you, right?
Yeah, but after I'd won the case and after I'd served the time, he did, and he made it clear, and he made it clear in his public statement that in your country you have a pardon of mercy and a pardon of what's called expungement. In the first, you're not commenting on the person's guilt, you're just saying enough is enough. In the second, you're saying this should not have happened, this was an injustice, and that's what he did. And he did it after Alan Dershowitz, who acted for me, went through it with the White House Law Office. You know, there's under the White House counsel, there's an extensive group of lawyers there, and their conclusion was that my co-defendants and I should not have been charged. And we shouldn't have. None of us would ever dream of breaking a criminal statute in the U.S. or anywhere else.
What did you do within when you were going to prison after living, you know, a pretty lavish lifestyle? I mean, were you nervous about it? What did you internally to, like, make this a good experience? How did you sort of, did you lean on God? Did you get yourself out of victim consciousness?
You see, I always feel that life is a privilege, and unless you're terminally ill or something, you've got the sun comes up every day, and you can do something every day, you know, and it is a magnificent and a wonderful thing, life. You know, we take it for granted much of the time, True. But when you think about it, it's splendid. So it's amazing. I thought, you know, this may be dodgy, but I'll do my best. But in the meantime, I was fired with that great ideal of fighting to defend myself against false charges. So that gave me a cause. And then I was resolved to make the most of the environment to which I was confined. And I must say it was in many ways very interesting. I got on fine with everybody. I had no problems with anyone. I mean, a few of the people in the administration were obnoxious, but they were a little wary of me. I received a lot of prominent visitors, and I was writing columns in the National Review. Bill Buckley hired me after I was convicted as a columnist as a gesture of solidarity, and I could send it out by email. And I was always getting packages from the Supreme Court Courier as my appeal went on and so on. So the administration didn't want to bother me unless I challenged them, and I never challenged them. I made it clear that I did not consider it legitimate that I was there, but I was fighting them through the legal appeal system and not by trying to raise opposition to them within the walls of that minimum security place, or low security, not minimum, low security. So that they had no quarrel with me, and I only spoke to the warden once, and that was I was the only person ever invited who was a white skinned person to address Black History Month, and I did, and the warden was an African American woman, and she thanked me for what I said. It was the only exchange I ever had with the warden.
Why did they invite you to do that?
There were a couple of my books in the library, so they felt that since they had an authentic historian, they should ask me to say so. And I told them, some of the people, I mean, obviously it was a practically all African-American or Caribbean audience, and some of them were elderly, and from that era when they had to sit at the back of the bus and might not get served in a cafeteria and this kind of thing. So I said it wasn't my place to teach them their history, but I could say something about some of the white statesmen of America. So I mentioned that, you know, Benjamin Franklin started as a person with no particular opinions on slavery, but the last half of his life was head of the Abolitionist Society, and that Washington emancipated his slaves in his will, and Jefferson called slavery a fire bell in the night. But I ended by quoting Abraham Lincoln's famous statement from his second inaugural that if God wills that every drop of blood drawn by the lash shall be repaid by a drop of blood drawn by the sword. That is true and righteous. And I said, please, whatever has happened, and I know some very bad things have happened, don't forget that the greatest statesman in American history pledged to abolish slavery no matter how many white people died doing it. And indeed, 750,000, almost all of them white people, did die doing it. But, you know, so you're on history's side, you say. So they saw that it wasn't patronizing. I was being respectful, but I was putting the best case forward for reasonable white people who in general have been those who have governed America.
You're a big fan of Lincoln. You mentioned him a lot. Was he the greatest American of all time? And I didn't realize that he had overcome the tragic passing of his own children. That was something I learned.
Two of them and a rather mad wife too. And he was a slightly morose personality, but he never lost his sense of humor. And he never became angry. He was disappointed and not angry at the countless times he was let down by people.
It is hard
to think negative to say about him. You know, I mean, he was indomitable, but you know, he was an autodidact, a self-made. He only went to school for 2 years, but he ended up with one of the greatest legal practices in the United States, and was one of the greatest wordsmiths in the English language. On my own reading, I put him alongside Cardinal, now Saint John H. Cardinal Newman. Those two as the greatest prose writers in the English language, nonfiction prose writers. I'm not talking about, you know, Dickens and all the great novelists. Just nonfiction prose writers. Those were the two that I would say were the greatest in the 19th century. I mean, Lincoln became sort of artistic in his prose, you know, those who here gave their lives that nation might live. I mean, putting the same word into the same sentence, first as a noun and then as a verb, you know, it's very stylish, but without being ostentatious or pretentious.
No time for poetry, just the facts. That's what Kerouac said. But yeah, it's hard not Joe's to... to descend facts, into poetry, you know, sometimes. So that's interesting. Say what?
Jack Kerouac was a French Canadian. Look, what I remember from him is, "Whither goest thou in the night in thy shiny car, America?"
Beautiful. Is that from On the Road? That sounds like On the Road.
Yeah. The great unwashed butt, America.
Were you a fan of the Beats? I'm surprised you're so versed in Kerouac. Oh, do you know Ginsberg and all those guys too? Bukowski. Those used to be our heroes back in the day. Now they have the internet and you can't read anymore because no one has an attention span. But back then, those were the heroes.
Yeah, I admired Kerouac. The Beat as a group, I never got altogether on board with them. But Ginsberg, I thought, was more of a comic figure. And, you know, I mean, some of the displacements of lines he made were sort of a genius. I remember my friend Norman Podhoretz. Norman Podhoretz, who's very much alive, and the book that you kindly referred to is dedicated to him and Henry Kissinger, who died just after it was published. But Norman Podhoretz had a dispute with Ginsberg once, and so Norman left. And Ginsberg, they had been sitting in a second floor of someone's house. Ginsberg opened the window and said, "But Horace, I'll get you through your children." It just always struck me as a hilarious line. I mean, he obviously wasn't serious. He was just kind of mimicking a belligerent person.
Yeah. An interesting crew, that crew. Kerouac, yeah. Burroughs, Ginsberg. I mean, I agree. I'm the least fan of Ginsberg of them all, but Howl was just such an amazing poem, and so is Caddish. There's sometimes where he just landed so hard, and then there was lots of nonsense. Same thing with Bukowski. Bukowski was really genius sometimes, but lots of
William
it was just...
Burroughs was a pretty talented writer at times.
Absolutely.
Now, do you put Norman Mailer in with them or not?
Yeah, he was like their great uncle, right? He was a little older.
I did know him personally fairly well. And wow. I before I met him, I thought there's no way I would ever like this guy because, you know, he was quite outrageous at times, but he was a delightful man personally. I did like him.
That's amazing. So, like, would you define yourself primarily as a writer or as a businessman?
I would actually say financier and historian, and now I'm more of a historian than a financier. But it's important. It's been important to me to be a financier because I do have some aptitude for it, and there are all sorts of famous ways of formulating this view. But it is better to live comfortably than not if you have that choice or the ability to decide which it is.
Absolutely. Let me take a quick break, and we're going to touch on that right after these words on TNT.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future, with nutritious food to eat, a chance to learn, to get an education, and do incredible things. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams by ensuring that they have access to healthcare, education, life skills, and more so they can grow, thrive, and believe in themselves.
Gracias. Gracias.
Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
The next time you think you can illegally handle your mobile phone while driving and get away with it, think again. Phone detection cameras are in operation on New South Wales roads.
Hello?
So if you're driving and illegally handle your mobile phone, you can stop it or cop it.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we're back with Lord Conrad Black. So we were just talking about you being a historian, a financier, and a writer. Now your mind is going like to all these different areas, right? Do you sort of your knowledge of being a financier, does it go into your writing? Does it go into your study of history? Do you find sort of similarities in becoming an expert on all these diverging fields?
Not so much similarities in them as subjects and how you approach them, but there is some overlap. I mean, there's certainly a prodigious role of money in various forms in history. Money comes into, I mean, I'm really writing political history here, not so much cultural history or economic history, although they come into it. And I mean, on its face, the idea of presenting the political history of the world in three big volumes is preposterous, but it can be done. I'm almost through the second one, which will get us up to the American Revolution. And money is important, you know. In the first Roman triumvirate, Marcus Crassus was the wealthiest man in Rome. I mean, he owned the fire department in Rome, and he also had a brigade of arsonists who would go around and set fire to buildings. Then he would send the fire department to put out the fire if the owner of the building paid him enough. You know, this was, I mean, it was a pretty rough and tumble form of capitalism in those days. But and obviously money was important in my biography of Roosevelt in many ways. I mean, it was a wealthy family that he came from to begin with. You know, he's reviled as a socialist, but he also said, it's hard for a man with 5 children and 10 servants to make both ends meet. He wanted to make America safe for people who lived in 40-room houses on 1,000-acre estates like him. You know, he cared for the disadvantaged, but he cared for himself too.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, when you take on something like the political and strategic history of the world and, you know, volume one, where do you start with something like that? And what does it, what do you learn? How do you research something like that? And where do you take it? How does one even begin that? What's your process? Like, do you wake up early in the morning, put on coffee, write for 4 hours straight? How do you go about this?
It was logical in a way. As you said, I started with biographies, then I got to histories of countries. And then I concluded that, you know, I'm getting older and I wanted a sort of magnum opus, you know, big work, you see. And I thought this might be something that would be a useful contribution to the literature, that you'd get a real grasp of the continuous pattern of world political history, just how tribes and bands and clans and peoples governed themselves and conducted relations with others. And that it could be done in three volumes, albeit big volumes. And so I've done my best to make it accessible to people. The chapters are carefully identified and subdivided, and they're good indexes. So you can get whatever you want. You can move from back to front or not read a page of it for a year and start again or whatever you want. And it's all there. And now if you really want a lot of detail on, say, Abraham Lincoln, you're going to have to go and read Sandburg and all these other people about it, but you'll get the essence of him there and other prominent people. As to how I do it, no, I think all people who write do it either early in the morning or late at night, and I'm of the late at night school. I get a great deal written between about starting between 10 and 11 and going to sometimes as late as 4 o'clock, but usually about 3 o'clock, two to three in the morning. And when the world is quiet, you can get a great deal done. And
I used to be like that.
Pardon me?
I've changed into a morning person. I was like, I've made tons of records, and it was always like, yeah, you'd stay up till 7 in the morning sometimes and sleep till 4 p.m. and just be completely upside down. I operated like that for a long time, and now I've like sort of molded myself into getting up at 4 in the morning type of person.
That's quite a revolution. I'm trying to change it a bit now and go to bed a bit earlier and get up a bit earlier. But I mean, I don't sleep that much, but you know, I don't want to shortchange myself of sleep, you know. After a while, it's bad for you. But as to how other things happen, one thing about writing, and I imagine recording is somewhat the same, although it would depend on accessibility to technical facilities, I guess. But you can do it anytime and almost anywhere. You can write on an airplane, and you can write, if you just wake up in the middle of the night and feel like sitting down at your, you know, at your desktop and writing for an hour, you can do it. You can dictate into an iPhone and then transmit it later to yourself and slot it into your text, you know? So, first things first, I have to do what's bread on the table. But when other people are playing golf or tennis or something, then I would be writing, you see. I do just enough exercise to keep myself in good shape, but I use an artificial bicycle and I walk my wife's dog for a while late at night, and that gets me that keeps me in reasonable condition.
That's perfect. Because I'm an exercise enthusiast. I waste a lot of time in yoga classes and stuff like this where I could be doing proper work.
Is yoga for real though? I mean, it isn't really exercise, is it?
It is for real, man. When you come to Arizona, I'm taking you to a Bikram yoga class. You tell me if it's for real or not afterwards. the reason I changed my wake up time is I'm a father now. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, so I have to like get up early if I'm gonna like deal with that and do some work.
Well, are you
You're
a
father as well. What was that like becoming a father? You have, I think, three kids, right? Was that a huge part of your life? What did that do to your life?
Well, you look, it's very interesting. And obviously it compels your interest. I mean, you don't grudgingly take an interest in them. These are lives that you help create, and they're very, you know, like, of course, all children can be exceedingly tiresome at times, but they're very endearing, you know, and
both.
Yeah. It was my first wife, but she was quite a conscientious mother. And, you know, you do the usual things. You take them to the amusement park and take them to the zoo and take them around and, you know, take them, travel with them and things, take them overseas and wherever, you know, and but they grow up after a while. I mean, mine are all in their 30s and 40s now.
Do you remain close to them, or is it strained? I mean, families are complicated.
There's no strain, whatever. Our relations are excellent with all three of them.
Nice.
And with my ex-wife, I'm a very happy second marriage, my daughter lives in England, so I don't see her that often, but we're in touch quite a lot. And I do see my two sons who live not far from me, reasonably often. But I have two grandchildren. They're sweet little bunny rabbits, you know, but I'm not one of these guys, unlike Richard Nixon, for example, who likes to get down on all fours with tiny children who haven't learned to speak yet. I mean, some older people like that, but I'm not one of them. But I, as they learn to speak, I talk to them more and enjoy them. But nor am I one of these parents / grandparents who is constantly in the lives of my offspring. I'm not, but I'm here if they want me, and you know, we have dinner reasonably often. And
listen, you and Bill Maher have a lot in common. He doesn't like children either. I'm just kidding.
No, I didn't say I didn't like them.
I know. I'm making a joke. I'm doing a callback to Bill Maher. That's all.
Yeah. Well, I think he and I have. How should I put it? I think he's been quite friendly with some women that I know well, such as Ann Overbury.
Hi-yo. Now we're talking tea over here with Conrad Black. No.
My relations with Anne were not romantic, but she's a friend.
Okay. Let me ask you this real quick.
The fact that Bill Maher, I believe, did have a good and rather close relationship with her is a factor in his favor, in my opinion.
Right.
Very much.
I see. I know you bring up Abraham Lincoln a lot. He was a God-fearing man. How does God and spirituality factor into your life? I would imagine when you're doing something like going to prison and getting through that, you're sort of leaning. How much do you lean on spiritual stuff in times of turmoil? Or do you believe at all?
Yeah, no, I do, yeah. I was an atheist, but I decided that that was a mistake. And incidentally, this was... I can claim a similar experience to Woody Allen's, who said that his family, at the heart of it, was a profound religious distinction and difference, because his mother was an agnostic and his father was an atheist. Now, that sounds ludicrous and it's funny, but there was something of that in my background too. But I concluded that spiritual forces do exist, and therefore there is some supernatural intelligence that it is worth a try to propitiate. And so from there, it was a short step to concluding that there are divinely inspired people, and that Christ was certainly one of them. And there was no reason to doubt that he told St. Peter to found a church, and that for all its shortcomings, the Roman Catholic Church is the legitimate continuator of that church. So I traveled to Africa in 1971 to visit the former Archbishop of Montreal, Cardinal Léger, a very famous man in Canada. And I'd known him slightly in Montreal. And I asked I sat there in the middle of the jungles of the Cameroons in this old mission that he lived in, and discussed this with him for a few days. So he gave me a dispensation, and then I was eventually, some years later, received by the Cardinal in Toronto, who was a very dear friend of mine, Cardinal Carter. So I am a Roman Catholic. But with that said, I think religion's like sex. People should do what works for them, avoid what doesn't, within reason, respect the practices of others, and be discreet about what they do. I don't like zealots who are trying to convert you to whatever it is they're enthused about themselves. But I accept that missionaries are important sometimes, but that's not my that's not what I am. So I'm quite comfortable in my religion, but I don't wear it on my sleeve.
Now, just to take it to the where we are in the world.
By the way, we
now,
had a wonderful priest in the prison I was in who hated the Bureau of Prisons. He was from Nigeria, a wonderful man. And at the beginning of each service, he would say, you now for the next 40 minutes can reasonably pretend you're not in a prison. This room is not under That's the authority awesome. Bureau of Prisons, and he would say it's quite a, I wouldn't say inspiring, but encouraging.
That's inspiring. That's beautiful. That's beautiful on a lot of levels. I hate that this is almost over, man. I could talk to you for a long time. I really appreciate your time in doing this. Real quick, what do you think of the state of the world now as a history expert? Where we are now is kind of strange, right? I mean, where do you think we're heading? Are you a Trump guy? I would imagine he pardoned you. You probably got to vote for him over RFK Jr. or Biden, right? I don't know. Not to put words in your mouth, but where do you think we are in this world right now? Are you surprised by where we are?
A little bit where we are in the United States. In the world generally, I think, you know, it sort of reminds me of Mark Twain's description of Wagner's music. It's not as bad as it sounds. You know, when I was a young person, there were only about 12 or 14 countries in the world that were rich countries. And it's a much bigger number now. When I first went to the great country of Brazil in 1968, only half the population was literate. Now, virtually all of it is. India is partly a dysfunctional country, and China is a rather totalitarian country, but they're both pulling tens of millions of people out of poverty every year. The percentage of people in the world who are in a defined state of poverty, it's under 15% now. When I was a young person, it was well over 50%, over 60%. Progress exists. I mean, the first volume of my book, which we're ostensibly talking about here, We go from the Old Testament, when things were very primitively organized, to Augustus, when the Roman Empire was magnificently organized.
So, all right, I got to cut you off. I got to cut you off. Lord Conrad Black, thank you so much, man. Tell people where to find you and how to get your book real quick.
Thanks. Oh, yeah. Well, I forget my website, but if you just Google me, it'll be on there somewhere. But although I don't believe most of the rest of what's there. But
exactly.
The book is available, History of the World, Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. It's on Amazon. It's in a lot of bookstores, and you can get it in Kindle for under $10.
And it's an honor to speak with you, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on. I hope you...